My attention was distracted by a gentle pricking of some sharp point under my right ear, and a soft voice whispering, "Lie still, friend, and prosper. For the moment, speak, and you'll be talking to Shaitan." I've written elsewhere of the terror of being shocked awake by deadly danger, and of the freezing paralysis that follows. It's happened to me more than once. Why, in China, I was dragged out of bed into a midnight skirmish, and then into the presence of the lunatic leader of the Taiping Rebellion. But at least in that case, my panic was short-lived, since my kidnappers proved to be friends. No such luck in Habesh. Half-drunk as I was, there was no mistaking the threat of the knife point, the lamplit nightmare of the gleaming eyes and teeth in the black faces staring down at me, the gag thrust brutally into my mouth, and the grip of the hands that wrenched me to my feet and ran me from the room, down a rickety staircase, and into the pouring rain of a chill night. Robed figures with swords and spears were about me, and then a blindfold was whipped over my face, and I was being half-carried, half-thrust along, trying to yell for help through my gag, and almost swallowing the thing out of sheer funk. What made it doubly terrifying was the complete silence of my captors. Not an order, not a word or a threat after that gloating voice that had woken me. These were professional kidnappers, probably expert assassins, who knew exactly what they were doing, where they were taking me, and why. Although the wherefore didn't occur to me, fuddled with fright and liquor as I was, until I was flung down onto a stretcher, swiftly bound to it and borne off at a run. Only then, when I realized that I was not being hauled out to instant execution, did I ask myself who could be behind this abduction. The answer seemed horribly clear. Ulaba Walk, thirsting for vengeance, and remembering how she dealt with Yando was enough to bring me out in a lather of fear. Oh, Lord, and she'd had some ghastly notion of removing a victim's bones one at a time and keeping him in agony for months. Being unable to scream or spew, I could only lie terrified while they jolted me along at speed. Heaven knew how far we went, or how long it took. You ain't at your calculating best with a mind a-shudder and a belly full of drink, but I don't believe they could have kept up that pace more than an hour. Over 5 miles, perhaps, before they halted for a breather and set me down. The blindfold was stripped away, leaving me blinking in the glare of a torch in the hand of one of the men surrounding me. 7 or 8 of them, galas in white pajami trousers and belted robes, strapping fellows fully armed with spears and sickle swords, 1 or 2 with muskets, and their leader with a couple of horse pistols in his belt. He was one of your typical wallows, handsome as Lucifer, and every bit as kindly to judge from his sneering grin. But when I rolled my eyes in dumb appeal, he pulled out the gag. I was too parched to speak at first, but probably because he wanted to hear what I had to say, he signed one of the band who held a chaggle to my lips, and the first words I croaked out to confirm my suspicions were, "Where is she?" "The Queen, Ulaba Walk," says he. "Be patient. You will see her presently, and she will reward you for your services." It was the same soft mocking voice that had threatened me with a chat to old Nick, chuckling pleasantly as his gang grinned like a pack of wolves over a peasant, and I gibbered at him. "What the devil do you mean? Do you know who I am? A British officer, the envoy of Dejaz Napier, and by God, if you don't set me loose this instant, you'll swing higher than Haman, you black son of a bitch. Queen Mastiat will see to it, and that slut Ulaba won't be able to shield you." He struck me backhanded across the mouth. "Speak foully once more of Queen Ulaba Walk, and you'll be unable to speak to Shaitan. For before you die, I'll tear your tongue out." He slapped me again and resumed his mockery. "No one will know what has become of you, Farangi fool. Your Dejaz may ask what has happened to you, and Queen Ulaba Walk will lament your strange disappearance. Or I. By then she will have replaced the fat bitch. We shall not fail a second time. She may even order me, Gorum, to make a search, but by then not enough will remain of your filthy carcass to make a meal for a jackal pup." So, he wasn't a mercenary, as for a second I dare to hope, but a genuine Ulaba worshipper, one of the crazy conspirators who'd survived the botched coup to put her on the throne. And, thanks to Mastiat's idiotic indulgence, she was free to make a second attempt, and to butcher me. "Don't be a fool, Goram," said I, calm and quiet, for I saw yelling wouldn't serve with this one. Dedjus Napier and the Basha Falaka are cunning men who know Ulaba and her plots, and they'll trace you and hunt you down, aye, even if you run to the mountains of the moon. But release me, and you'll be rewarded. More money than you've ever seen. Why, they're giving $50,000 to Mastiat just as a gift. He clapped a hand over my mouth, and now he was stuffing the gag back between my teeth. He might be loyal to Ulaba, but he daren't risk his gang being tempted by a fortune in silver. I tried to spit it out, but he had it bound in a trice, and I could do nothing but heave and roll my eyes. Then he spat in my face. If you were tortured for a year, it would be too light a punishment. You would have slain our royal lady, she who had loved you and stood your friend. And you think you can buy me, her sworn warrior who lives only to see her on her rightful throne? He spat again and shouted to the others to bear me up. So we set off once more through the night. The rain had stopped, but thunder was rumbling in the distance, with an occasional crackle of lightning in the night sky. Then the pace was slackening as we went up a steep ascent, and now there was a glow ahead, and a challenge to which Gorham replied, and I was carried between great boulders into a rock-girt clearing where a great fire burned, and a half-score of gallows were resting on their weapons. I was dropped without ceremony in front of a seated figure, cloaked and hooded, and my fearful gaze took in long and beautiful legs, elegantly crossed, and above them the lithe figure and handsome face, cold as a basilisk's, of Ulaba Walk. There was no trace of the fury she'd shown at our last encounter. For a long moment she looked down at me, with a lack of expression that made my skin crawl, and then she rose, shrugging off her cloak, and came to stand beside Gorham, one hand on her hip, the other toying with her braids. But not a word did she say, and paid no heed when Gorham, having called a question to some sentry out in the darkness, frowned and shrugged and muttered in her ear. Without taking her eyes from mine, she held out her hand, and Gorham drew his knife and handed it to her, grinning. She stropped it once, slowly, on her palm, and nodded. And, at a word from Gorham, three of his ruffians seized me, two at the shoulders, one at the ankles, to prevent my struggling. She signed to Gorham to hold out his spear, and to my horror, cut the ghastly trophies from its head, slowly and deliberately, to a delighted murmur from the onlookers. She watched me intently, and must have seen the terror in my eyes, for the chiseled lips smiled for the first time, as Gorham dropped to one knee beside me and wrenched at my waistband, trying to tear it open. The horror of that moment is with me still, and always will be. The ring of grinning black faces crowding closer to watch, Gorham's foul breath in my nostrils, the bestial leer of the scoundrel gripping my ankles, the knowledge of the agonizing, unspeakable abomination Ulaba Walk was about to inflict on me as she placed her feet one either side of my legs and prepared to stoop, knife in hand. And beyond her, on the very edge of the firelight, there appeared a figure which could only be a guardian angel come down from heaven to save poor Flashy from his tormentors, for it was female and beautiful, with flowing hair beneath its little white headdress like a halo, naked to the waist as an avenging fury should be, with a spear raised to hurl. And it wasn't a hallucination or vision conjured by superstitious funk, for she was letting fly with the spear, and the man at my ankles was rearing up with a shriek of mortal anguish, eyes bulging and hands clutching at the bloody point emerging from his chest, flopping forward and spewing gore as he fell over me, which effectively cut off my view of the battle royal which was breaking out all round. The hands at my shoulders were gone. Gorham was no longer tearing at my breeches. Oaths and screams were in my ears, and shots were ringing out, and steel clashing as I strove to throw off the body of the dying man sprawled over me. He slid sideways, choking on his own blood, and I lay bound and helpless, staring at my incredible salvation. For a wild moment, I wondered if my brief delusion of divine aid hadn't been true after all, for now there was a good score of ministering angels racing into the firelight, half-naked women who howled like harpies and slashed right and left at the gallus. But only for a moment. Angels don't shout war cries or squeal with pain when they're wounded, nor do they yell with delight while two of them hold an enemy down and a third rips him open. And they don't peal like big side chargers either. My spear-thrower had looked like a statue of Diana, but some of her companions were as broad as they were long and could have thrown chests with King Gezo's Dahomey Amazons. They fought with appalling savagery, and the Gallas were hard put to it to hold them. For a few minutes the fight surged to and fro, and then the attackers came leaping out of the dark. The Gallas fell back as the little darling swept into them in the final charge, hair flying and jugs bouncing, and as two more of my captors went down, hideously slashed, I knew there could be only one end to it. Gorham knew it too, the swine, but where I would have turned and run, the spiteful brute was faithful unto death to his damned Ulubar. He cut down one woman, parried a thrust from another, sprang back, shot a look of pure venom in my direction, barked an order, and leapt back into the fight. And to my horror, two of his ruffians broke away from the melee and snatched up my stretcher. But not to carry me out of harm's way. Oh, no, not a bit of it. They threw me on the fire. As you may know, during my service in the Punjab, I had the misfortune to be basted on a gridiron over a slow fire. And bloody disagreeable it was, leaving me singed and smoking, but mercifully underdone. An open blaze is different. 2 or 3 seconds and I imagine you burst into flames unless your stretcher happens to be made of stout bullock hide. But even then, it's only a matter of time before you come all over of a heat, and your one hope is the arrival of the fire brigade at speed. By God, I was lucky. I crashed into the heart of the blaze with a tremendous shower of sparks, and for a heartbeat, there was no sensation before the flames began to lick at my feet, which overhung the stretcher. And I'd have been horribly maimed at least if one of the angels, because that's what she was, even if she looked like a female gorilla, hadn't thrust her spear beneath my stretcher and tipped me clear of the blaze with a tremendous heave, which deposited me face down with a seared arse and back, but no lasting damage. She and her mates turned me over, and one of them had the wit to pour the contents of a chaggal over me, for I was smouldering painfully, and when they pulled the gag out, I woke the echoes with complaint and gratitude. Mostly complaint, but they very civilly cut me loose from the stretcher, which was uncomfortably hot still. Gorilla Jane helped me to a drink, and they set me with my back to a boulder, where I could take stock of the astonishing scene. There wasn't a Gala left standing. The onslaught of these amazing females had overwhelmed them in minutes, and by the excited yells and ghastly chopping sounds, their wounded were being dispatched, with my spear-hurling Diana supervising the slaughter. Her followers were a mixed bag, mostly young and as handsome as Ab women are, but one or two were older and pretty puggish. They were in various states of undress, despite the night chill, some in tunics of Ulubar's cut, others in skirts or trousers, and a few of the younger vain misses flaunted themselves like Diana in flimsy headdresses, cloaks and loincloths, a most fetching rig. Every woman jill of them was fully armed. Amazons, but very different from the Dahomey variety, who were under discipline and drilled like guardsmen. These were irregulars, and, unlike Gezo's Gorgons, they behaved like women. Half of them were chattering round their own wounded, with squeals of concern and comfort. One very young member of the Bare Chest Brigade was weeping buckets and pouring dust on her head while they covered the face of her dead comrade. And suddenly she was up and raving shrilly, plunging her spear again and again into a Gala corpse until she noticed a live target hard by. Ulubar Walk! She was bleeding from a dozen wounds, held spread-eagled with Diana apparently interrogating her, when the hysterical stabber ran in and planted her spear in Ulubar's body. In an instant the rest were hacking at her like things demented, while the stabber lay wailing and Diana shrugged and turned away, bored-like. I was physically sick on the spot. The Lord knows I had cause to loathe and fear her for the ghastly revenge she had been about to take on me, and I'll not pretend I was sorry to have her cancelled out. But to see her slashed to pieces, that beautiful body that I'd held in my arms and loved to ecstasy, butchered by these creatures from the pit, was more than I could bear. Just for an instant, I had the vision of her, gleaming wet and naked, laughing on the black rock in Lake Tana, and I absolutely wept and moaned. Oh, I'm vile, all right. We'd travelled well together until her death had become necessary to my survival, and I'd tried to murder her without compunction. Foul work, indeed. But would I rather she was still living and doing what she'd been about to do? On the whole, no. But I still stopped my ears against the awful chopping sounds and eldritch laughter of the executioners. Having known Ulubar, I dare say, I shouldn't have been astonished to encounter Ab fighting women. But no advance warning could have prepared me for these terrifying bitches. Who the blazes could they be? Whose side were they on? And what had I to hope from them? They'd rescued me, no doubt, on the ground that anyone whom their enemies wanted to castrate and roast alive must have something to be said for him. But that didn't make 'em bosom pals. Speaking of which, I couldn't help admiring Diana's as she strode across in my direction. She knew it, too, sweeping back the tails of her cloak and striking a pose, a hand on her pistol butt. Blue eyes, begod. Piercing bright in a lovely face that was no darker than tawny, peacock-proud and sassy with it. And now came an even greater shock, for she was standing aside to make way for two who were following her, and they were men. I hadn't seen either in the fight or its aftermath, but from the deference Diana showed, one of them at least must be a big gun indeed. He was small and portly and black as your boot, rolling along on stubby legs and standing arms akimbo to survey me. He was bald, with a fringe of woolly white hair, and wore the red fringe sharma of consequence. His companion looked like a bodyguard, for he wore a steel back and breast, and carried spear and sword, a tall, likely Adonis, middling dark, and moved like a dancer, taking station at Portly's shoulder. All three regarded me in silence for a moment, and then Portly opened the bowling, most disconcertingly.
"I know what you are, but not who you are."
He spoke in Amharic with authority.
"So, tell me your name, and what have you done that these Gala savages should wish to slay you?"
I answered in Arabic, taken aback but head up. "I'm English. My name is Flashman. I'm a colonel, a ras, a chief in the British army advancing on Magdala. May I ask who you are?" There was a gasp from Diana and some of the women who presumably understood Arabic. They'd suspended the agreeable task of polishing off the enemy wounded at Portly's arrival and crowded in to listen. Diana dropped to one knee to study me more closely. Gad, she was a little satin stunner, and I bestowed my most courtly smile on her, which she received with a startled look, followed by a disdainful toss of the head and tits. Portly was equally unimpressed.
"I know what a colonel is, and who I am can wit," snaps he. "So, how came a British officer in the hands of the Gala?"
He stamped impatiently.
"And why should they seek your death?"
This was dangerous ground, and I must hedge until I'd found out who Portly and these dreadful women were. But for his presence, I'd have taken them for bandits, like the female dacoits of India. He was obviously someone of official importance. Could he be an agent of some petty ruler like Menelek or Gobazi, of whom I'd heard so much? Or even of Mastiat's rival, the despised Wakiti. All I knew for certain was that the women enjoyed killing Galas, and weren't likely to be well disposed to anyone whose task it was to enlist them as allies. So I assumed my gallant, pathetic expression, and asked Diana if I might have a reviving sip of Tej and some food, just a morsel would do, to revive me after my ordeal. Portly made an ab noise which would translate as "bah." But Diana, dear girl, snapped her fingers, and Gorilla Jane hastened to offer a flask and wallet of toasted beef. I thought quickly, as I imbibed and chewed, decided I'd best not try Portly's patience by asking a second time who he was, and resolved, since the truth wouldn't do, to follow the golden rule by sticking as close to it as possible. "I'd been scouting ahead of Napier's advance," I said, "and had been ambushed by these people. Gallas, had he called them? But thank heaven he and his splendid ladies had turned up, and if he would be so obliging as to return me to my army, the British Dejaz, who was noted for his generosity, would reward them with dollars and all kinds of good things, food, drink, weapons, and of course clothes, silks and satins and ornaments." The women showed eager interest, but Portly gave another furious stamp.
"Do I look like a fool? You dare talk to me of dollars and silks as though I were a fellaheen beggar or a Bedawi, and evade my question."
He drew breath, and Diana surprised me by putting in her oar unexpected with a curl-of-the-lip smile.
"Would your Dejaz's generosity give us the spoiling of Magdala?"
Her women gasped eagerly. The bodyguard burst out laughing, and before Portly could explode, I said that I couldn't answer for the Dejaz, but whatever the spoil of Magdala might be, she could count on getting equivalent value, and meanwhile, the sooner I was restored to my army.
"Perhaps he will not be able to take Magdala.
The bodyguard spoke for the first time.
It is the strongest amber in Habesh.
He'll take it, soldier, says I. Have no doubt of that.
With the help of the Gala warriors of Queen Mastiat,
bawls Portly, taking me flat aback, although I tried desperately to cover it.
Gala warriors? These people? I gestured at the bodies. I don't understand. Why should the British seek anyone's help? We have no need of it, and I know nothing of this queen.
You lie!
Cries Portly.
All Habesh knows by now that the British seek alliance with the Wolo Gala, and who are you to be ignorant?
He shot out a fat finger.
You have been sent by your Dejas to win the Galas with silver and a crown for Mastiat. So why, then, should they wish you dead?
When in doubt, play the bewildered loony. That I was blown upon to the fair end of Kingdom Come was plain. Ulaba had been right. Yando's gang had guessed who I was and spread the word. But I daren't admit anything to unknown accusers in a country where everybody knew the far end of a fart before it had even erupted. So I babbled.
I don't know what you mean, my dear sir. How should I know why these foul villains wanted to kill me? As to winning anyone with silver,
I threw up my hands. Please, if you'll only escort me to my army, you'll receive a mighty reward for my return, I assure you. I continued in this vein while he stood glaring, and then Diana, who'd been eyeing me like an Arcadian nymph, mistrustful of a satyr of doubtful repute, put in her confounded oar again.
If we feed him into the fire, little by little he will speak, says she.
But Portly seemed undecided, for he turned away, and after a word with his bodyguard, told Diana curtly to muster the women and prepare to march. She gave a disappointed grunt and issued brisk orders for them to fall in as soon as they'd finished despoiling and mutilating the dead. You can guess what that meant. And I was happy to avert my eyes from that bloodied ground and desecrated bodies. And Ulaba's among them. And those barbarian sluts, some of them mere slips of girls, chattering and laughing as they went about their grisly work.
Are you sick, Ferengi? Why do you look away? Does the sight of blood distress you?
I looked up to find the bodyguard leaning on his spear. Portly was off on a frolic of his own, seemingly.
Nay, surely not. You have seen your own blood run from a wound.
He pointed to the star-shaped scar on my hand.
A bullet did that.
A clean wound is one thing, soldier, says I, and nodded towards the lady's debollocking circle. That is another.
Aye, true, says he. Yet it is what the Galas would have done to you, while you still lived. Do the British not believe in retribution, then? Eye for eye, burning for burning.
Diana crowed with laughter.
We do not take their eyes!
She added nauseating particulars, and I wondered if I'd ever found a beauty so detestable.
We believe in it, I told the bodyguard. That don't mean I have to watch your disgusting bitches!
It came out as a high-pitched snarl. Reaction was overtaking me after the horrors I'd seen and near experienced, and I was on the brink of spewing again.
Perhaps he is cold with fear at the sight of fighting women, jeers Diana. We can unman them before the fight as well as after.
She seated herself on a rock, stretching her legs and folding her arms across her presence for a good boy.
So they fear us, which is why our lord Tuwudros has made special choice of us, and sends us forth to raid and ambush and strike terror in the hearts of his enemies. Is your heart stricken, wrath of the British?
The jibe was wasted. Only one word mattered. Your lord Tuwudros? Who the hell is he, then? Even as I spoke, I knew the answer, and the bodyguard confirmed it, shaking his head at my ignorance.
Why, the Emperor, the King of Kings, Monarch of Habesh, and by the power of God, the conqueror that will be of Egypt and Jerusalem. You know him as Theodore.
I could only stare at them in utter consternation. Theodore's people, the last folk on God's earth I wanted to see. I ain't often at a dead nonplus, but I was then, for this was the fear that had been in my mind for weeks, of falling into the hands of the mad tyrant who inflicted unspeakable tortures on his victims, who'd beaten missionaries and lashed their servants to death, who'd stretched Consul Cameron on the rack, and my God, who knew, from what Portly had said, of my mission to Mastiat to enlist the Galas against him. Portly?
Could he be Theodore in person? For all I knew, he might. But surely not. In a night skirmish away from Magdala, where he was supposed to be preparing to fight or run? No, impossible. But I was bound to ask. Diana clapped a hand over her mouth at the question, and the bodyguard laughed outright.
Does the soldiers of the English Queen know so little of their quarry that they think such a fat little hippo as Damesh could be the great emperor, the Lion of Judah? Did he look like a warrior king, a veteran of 30 years in arms?
He glanced at Diana.
Yeah, Miriam. What would Gobazi or Menelek say to Damesh as emperor?
Ask rather what Theodore would say to a fool who mistook Damesh for the King of Kings, says she. How would he punish such an insult?
Who knows the mind of kings? They are beyond the ken of common folk.
He put his head on one side, regarding me.
But I should not account this one a fool as you do. Did you not hear him answer Damesh, saying much but telling nothing?
He leaned towards me, nursing his spear, his eyes intent on mine.
Perhaps Damesh is right, and he is the kind of man that Dedja's Napier would have sent to Mastiat. A man of a long head, skilled in dissimulation, and never aiming where he looks.
He smiled.
You are that man, are you not, Ras Flashman?
Then he was solemn again.
When you come to stand before Tewodros, do not try to deceive him. He loves truth, above all things, and rewards those who deal fairly with him. And takes the hands and feet of those who lie, and feeds the rest alive to the birds and beasts,
taunts Miriam, Diana.
Peace, you hyena in woman's shape.
He nodded to me.
I advise as a friend, Englishman. Remember my words.
He was turning away. My mouth was dry with alarm, but I forced my voice to be steady.
I'd be a fool if I forgot them, Your Majesty.
Miriam Diana threw back her head with a yell and gave her thigh a ringing slap.
He knew you! By the power of God, he knew you!
She was grinning with delight.
They are not such blind fools, the English.
The bodyguard who ruled Abyssinia had turned back abruptly, but the solemn look was gone and his voice was suddenly harsh.
How did you know me? What did you see?
He looked from me to her and struck his breast in anger.
What is there here that denotes a king? This is a common soldier.
He shook his spear and slapped himself again, taking two abrupt steps towards me. I gave back, for in a mere moment his earnest, almost friendly manner had given way to shouting rage. It was as though another man had got into his skin, and Miriam was on her feet as though to intervene.
How did you know me?
He demanded, and jabbed a finger at me.
Have a care. Do not pretend that you saw royalty in my looks and speech, that you could not mistake the descendant of Solomon and Sheba, of Constantine and Alexander. I despise that kind of lie, that courtly flattery. Do not offend me with it.
Since that was precisely what I'd been about to do, I was briefly at a loss. I twigged early enough that he was no common spear-carrier. There's no lack of abs with handsome figureheads, with fine aquiline noses for looking down, but he had spoken with that calm assurance that you don't find in the private soldier, and I'd marked him down as an Abyssinian gentleman ranker, so to speak. But there had been something else.
You spoke of your companion, Damesh, as a fat little hippo.
Common men do not talk so of superiors who wear the red-fringed shama. That made me wonder. I climbed to my feet.
But when you cry, peace, hyena, to one who commands the Emperor's fighting women and wears a silver shield on her arm, then I do more than wonder. And whether you despise courtly flattery or no, I have stood before the face of many kings and queens in my time and know the look. Not at once, perhaps, but at last.
There's no doubt about it. I'm good at dealing with balmy savages. They scare the bile out of me, and perhaps terror lends wings to my wits. For when I think of the monsters I've conversed with and come away with a whole skin, more or less, Mangas, Colorado, Ranavalona, General Sang Colinsen, Crazy Horse, Dr. Arnold, God knows who else, well, it took more than luck, I can tell you. You must know when to grovel and scream for mercy, but also when to take them aback with impudence or argument or pure bamboozle. To find myself in the presence of Mad King Theodore was enough to turn my bowels to buttermilk, but having seen him quiet and crazy in quick time, and realized that he was intelligent well above par, like many madmen, I knew that straight talk and a firm front to cover my quaking guts were my best bet. Oh, God, I hope so, and tried not to quiver as I waited, watching him.
End of CD 6. CD 7.
You never can tell what they'll do when you answer 'em cool and apparently steady. Some laugh, some ponder, some snarl, some set about you. I'm thinking of Arnold. And some, like Theodore, study you in disquieting silence. Then,
you were quite wrong, you see, Miriam. He is no fool.
Your Majesty was wrong also, says she pertly. He knew you.
Not until I had studied him and seen what manner of man he was. Damash served his turn.
To me, he said,
what success had you with Queen Mastiat? Oh, we can be plain now. I have known for weeks that a British envoy was on his way to seek her help, and since you reached her yesterday, we have been watching. Fortunately for you.
He gestured towards the gala dead.
Did you not prosper with her?
If I said no, I hadn't prospered, and he had a spy at her court to tell him otherwise, or had intercepted my message to Napier, I was done for. If I told him the truth, that the Gallas were taking the field to cut him off, God knew what he would do. I'd already seen how swiftly his mood could change. I daren't risk it. I said there'd been no time even to broach Napier's request, and was subjected to another silent stare.
No time for talk,
says he.
But time for these,
he gestured again,
to bring you out for death. No, that is not Queen Mastiat's way. Not with a fine tall soldier, sniggers Miriam,
who seemed to go in no awe of him at all. He paid her no heed.
So, who condemned you, and why?
I told him the truth of it, since it could do no harm, and he presumably knew that Ulubar Walk had guided me south. We were separated by your riders at the Silver Smoke. She chose to think I had abandoned her, and these dead men were her hirelings to murder me. I pointed at the clearing. And there she lies.
Ulubar Walk? Dead?
Theodore stared and wheeled abruptly, striding to the group about Ulubar's body. They scattered like birds, Miriam following him in some alarm.
I saw it was a woman, but I did not know her, Negus, truly.
It is no matter,
says Theodore. He looked down at what remained of Ulubar and shrugged without disgust.
She was a stinging gadfly, a sower of discord, a trouble in the eyes of God and man. She coveted her sister's throne, they say. Behold her now.
She coveted men by all accounts,
says Miriam, and gave me her jeering grin.
Were you her lover, Ras of the British?
I was not about to mention a lady's name, but her question seemed to catch Theodore on the raw somehow, for he stared hard at her, head back, and then at me, and then at her again, and smiled at last, crooking a finger.
Hither, wantan,
says he, and she came to his side. He put an arm about her waist and fondled her chin, and she purred like a kitten and nuzzled him.
Speak not of love to fine tall soldiers, says he.
So, that explained the license she enjoyed, one of his concubines, obviously, as well as commanding his killing women. Versatile female. And Theodore of Abyssinia was as jealous as the next man. And now Damash came rolling back, followed by a groom leading two horses. Behind him the women had finished their revolting chore and were assembling more or less in ranks, except for Gorilla Jane, who was dragging along one of the gala corpses. Then I saw that it wasn't a corpse but a living being, bleeding from a dozen wounds. Theodore, still with his arm about Miriam, addressed me.
Ras Flashman, do you come with the power of the English Queen to destroy me, who have wished for nothing but peace between her throne and mine, and laboured by the power of God to that end against the wickedness of evil men? Yet I hold no malice in my heart towards you, or your dead jars Napier, who writes cordially to me and I to him. I take you to be my guest at Magdala, where we shall look into each other's hearts in love and friendship."
He seemed to expect an answer, so I said, "Much obliged, Negus." He kissed Miriam and toyed with her hand a moment.
"Bring the rest to Islangi," says he, and mounted.
Damash was budged into the saddle by the groom, but as they prepared to ride off, Gorilla Jane cried that here was the Gala chief still alive, though incomplete, and what should be done with him? At her feet, with her companions, crouched over it like vultures, was that dreadful thing, stirring feebly, and I saw it was Gorham. Miriam brightened.
"We shall question him, Negus."
"A Gala warrior will tell you nothing," says Theodore.
He stood in his stirrups, a hand raised.
"The blessing of God upon you, brave women, and a blessing also on you, Ras Flashman, and his mercy and peace."
He wheeled his horse, and as he passed Gorilla Jane and the shattered wreck of Gorham, he added,
"Throw him on the fire."
So they did. I spent a week as guest of the Emperor Theodore, and it was one of the longest of my life. How our prisoners, Cameron and co., endured it for 2 solid years is beyond me. There may be nothing worse than being in the hands of a deadly enemy, but finding yourself at the mercy of a lunatic runs it close, for there's no telling what he'll do. Load you with chains or send you presents. Threaten you with flogging or swear eternal friendship over a glass of Tej. Discuss the causes of the American Civil War, or invite you to kill him because his life has become a burden. That was Theodore, the maniac who held our lives in his hands, torturing our gracious Queen's consul after death and firing 21-gun salutes to celebrate her birthday. Not the worst host I've ever been billeted on, perhaps, but quite the most unpredictable. There was no way of foreseeing, as they brought me away from that place of slaughter where the Gallas died, that those 7 days of horror and hope, of living on the razor's edge, were to see the final act of the astonishing melodrama, part tragedy, part farce, known as the Abyssinian War. For me, it was the last mile of that wild journey that had begun a few short months ago in Trieste. I tell you it as it was. It's all true. It was still pitch dark and drizzling gently when we set out. Miriam and I and a few others mounted, with the rest of those female crocodiles trotting behind. I didn't reckon we'd gone far by sunrise, 5 miles perhaps, and then we were in a stony desolation of tall cliffs and deep ravines, rounding a mighty eminence of rock on our right hand, and following a saddle that connected it to another towering flat-topped height a mile or so ahead, which came into full view as the dawn mist lifted and the sunlight struck it, and turned it for a moment into a mountain of gold. I asked where we were.
"Selesi," says Miriam, pointing ahead, and then jerking a thumb at the cliff to our right. "Fala."
These were the names I'd heard only yesterday in Fazel's room at Mastiat's camp. Yesterday. Dear God, it seemed an eternity ago. I pictured that sand table model and tried to match it to what I was seeing. Yes, there below us was the road that Theodore had made for his artillery, winding between Fala and Selesi, with folk and carts moving along it, and gangs of what looked like men in chains. As near as I could judge, we were coming from the southwest, and if you look at my map, you'll see what was about to come into my view as we rounded Fala. Beyond the saddle, at the foot of Selesi, was a group of tents, or pavilions, rather, for they were larger and set apart from the camp of little bivouacs at the northern end of the long plain that I knew must be Islangi. And at the far southern end of that plain, less than 2 miles from where I sat transfixed, was a great towering cylinder of black rock, sprouting out of the plain like a column fashioned by some giant sculptor. And the reason I sat transfixed was that I knew what it was before Miriam said the word. Magdala. So, there it was, the Eagle's Nest, the stronghold where Mad King Theodore had held a handful of British and German captives for 4 years, his last outpost where he would be trapped with nowhere to run. For I didn't doubt that Mastiat's regiments would even now be marching to cut him off from that wilderness of peaks in the hazy southern distance. And there, below me on Islangi, was his army. How many strong? 7,000? 10? Was he waiting there to meet Napier in the open? Or would he retire into Magdala, pulling up the metaphorical drawbridge? Gad, if he did, that rock would be a bastard to take by storm. Or might he even march to meet Napier, who must be close by now, surely?
And on the thought, I turned to gaze northwestwards, straining my eyes across that rock-strewn plain that stretched away across the Aragee Plateau, directly below us, 5 miles and more to a distant dark line running across our front, which I knew must be the chasm of the Bekello. From it, the King's Road wound across the undulating land to Aragee, and between Fala and Salesi to the very foot of Magdala. Surveying that broken ground bordered by hills and gullies, it struck me that Theodore could do a sight worse than choose the third course, advance beyond Aragee to lay ambushes in the rough country bordering his road. Better that than being besieged in Magdala, or meeting our people on the flat plain of Islamgi, where they'd make mincemeat of him in open battle. Miriam gave a cry of excitement and stood in her stirrups, shading her eyes and pointing. And, as I followed her finger, I felt that same wild thrill of disbelief, giving way to joy that I'd felt in the garden of Lucknow, when we'd heard, ever so faint on the morning air, the far whisper of the pipes that told us Campbell was coming. For it was there, through that shimmering heat haze and the last wisps of mist, on the lip of the plateau beyond the Bekello, as though to a cue, the last actor was coming onto the stage, with no sound of pipes or rumble of gunfire, heralded only by tiny shining pinpricks of light, barely visible in the dusty distance. And I'd have given a thousand for a glass just then, for I'd seen them too often to be mistaken, lance points catching the morning sun. But whose? Bengali native cavalry? Sindhis? For instinct told me they must be ours, and now it was confirmed by eyes that were younger and sharper than mine. "Farangi!" cries Miriam with an added oath. "On Dalanta! The niggers was right. Those vermin of Dawunt and Dalanta should have been destroyed. They have lain down before your people. Aye, they come. See there, they come." "How do you know they're my people?" I didn't know then that Theodore had fallen out with the tribes on the Dalanta Plateau, which lies north of the Bekello River, slap across Napier's line of march, and that the obliging niggers had cleared the way for us, but I could read the consternation on Miriam's pretty face.
"There can be no one else. We had word when they crossed the Jeddah 3 days ago. Now they are on the lip of the Bekello, and once across the ravine..."
She gave a disgusted shrug and spat, and I gazed towards Salvation, and concluded reluctantly that I daren't try a run for it, not on a miserable ab-screw that was bound to founder within a mile. Besides, all I had to do was wait. Napier was far closer than I'd dare to hope, and even with the Bekello chasm to cross, which I knew from Fazel's model was 3/4 of a mile deep, he couldn't be more than 2 days' march away. I absolutely smacked my palm in delight, and Miriam cried out scornfully,
"Ha! You rejoice at their coming! But what of their going when the Amhara drive them like sheep back to Egypt?"
I knew she didn't believe it, just from her sullen scowl. "If the Amhara are mad enough to try, they'll find those sheep are wolves," I told her. "They'll eat your army of peasants at a bite. No, they'll not need to, for their guns will blow your rabble to bits, and the elephants will trample the dead. Unless Theodore has the sense to go to ground on that bloody rock," I might have added, but didn't.
"Elephants?"
She shuddered. "They're mortal scared of Jumbo, you see, being convinced he can't be tamed." She looked thoughtful, and as we rode on, I guess she was wondering how she'd fare in person if Theodore took a hiding. Sure enough, after a moment,
"Suppose your people triumphed. What would they do to Habesh?"
"To a pretty lass like you, you mean? I know what I'd do."
"No," cries she fiercely. "You would protect me."
"Would I now? In gratitude for wanting me fed into the fire?"
"You were a prisoner then."
She rode closer and said in a low tone,
"Now, if your people triumphed, you could do me good, and I would be grateful."
Softly, with her knee against mine, if you please. "My dear, you're a girl after my own heart," says I. "But what if your side won, eh? They won't, but just suppose.
Then I would protect you from the wrath of Theodore, as I shall even now."
"I doubt if he'll be wrathful with me just now," says I. "Not with the British army on his doorstep." She stared at me.
"You do not know him. Oh, believe me, Ras of the British, you know him not at all."
In fact, she was wrong. I did know him all too well, but I'd forgotten, you see.
I thought of him as the well-spoken soldier I'd mistaken for a bodyguard, given to sudden bursts of temper over trifles, if you like, and didn't care two straws about roasting an enemy, but that's African war for you. But I'd not associated that man, who'd seemed to be sane enough, and a reasonable being, with the ghastly tales I'd heard of atrocities, of women and children massacred, of frightful tortures practiced on countless victims. I'd forgotten Gondar and that dreadful garden of the crucified. Yet that horror had been the work of the intelligent, earnest man who'd cross-examined me so briskly, and smiled and joked and dallied with the bonny bint riding beside me. It didn't seem possible. Until we rode down from the Fala saddle to the camp below Salesi. Then it became all too horribly plain. The first intimation came when we had to halt at the King's Road while a procession of Ab prisoners shuffled by. There were hundreds of them, in the most appalling condition, starved skeletons, virtually naked, many of them covered in loathsome sores. Every one of them was chained, some in fetters so heavy they could barely drag them along, others manacled wrist to ankle, with chains so short you couldn't stand upright, but must totter along bent double. The stench was fit to choke you. And to complete their misery, they were driven along by burly guards wielding giraffes, the hippo-hide whips which are the Ab equivalent of the Russian gnaut. "Who in God's name are they?" I asked Miriam. "Rebels?" "You find no living rebels here," says she. "They die where they're taken." "So these are criminals. What the hell have they done?" Her answer defied belief, but it's what she said with a shrug, and I was to learn that it was gospel true. "What have they done?" "Smiled when the king was in ill humour, or scowled when he was merry. Served him a dish that was not to his taste, or mentioned tapeworm medicine, or spoken well of someone he dislikes, or came in his way when he was drunk." She laughed at my incredulity. "You don't believe me. Indeed, you do not know him." "By God, I don't believe you." "You will." She surveyed the last of the pitiful coffle as it staggered past. "True, not all have committed these offences. Some merely had the misfortune to be related to the offenders." "Oh, yes, that is enough, truly." "But for smiling? Tapeworm medicine? And he takes it out on whole families? How long have they been chained, for God's sake?" "Some for years. Why he brings them down now from their prison on Magdala, who knows? Perhaps to preach to them. Perhaps to kill them before your army arrives. Perhaps to free them. We shall see." "He must be bloody mad," cries I. "Well, I'd heard it said often enough, but you don't think what it means until you see the truth of it at point blank. And here was this lovely lass riding at ease in the warm sunlight, tits at the high port, and talking cool as you please of a monster to rival Caligula. She must have read the stricken question in my eye, for she nodded, "Yes. He is a dangerous master, as his ministers and generals would tell you." She smiled, chin up. "But those who know him, and his moods, and how to please him, find in him a devout and kind and loving friend. But even they must learn to turn his anger, for it is terrible, and when the fit is on him, he is no better than a beast. Is that mad, Ras Flashman of the British? Come." She led the way across the road to the nearest pavilions, the first of which was the great red royal marquee with carpets spread on the ground about it, guards on the fly and servants everywhere. Groups of men in red-fringed shamas were gathered before the other large pavilions, evidently waiting, and the plain beyond was covered almost to Magdala by a forest of bivouacs and shelters. The army of Abyssinia was at rest. Thousands of men loafing and talking and brewing their billies, like any other soldiers, save that these were black. And instead of shirt sleeves and dangling galluses, there were white shamas and tight leggings. And as well as the piled firearms, there were stands of spears and racks of sickle-bladed swords. They looked well, as the gallus had done, and perhaps as soon as tomorrow they would go out to face the finest army in the world under one of the great captains. And how many of them would come well to bedtime? How many Sindhis and King's Own and Dukes and Baloch, for that matter? Fall out, Flashy, thinks I. This ain't your party. Lie low, keep quiet, and above all, stay alive. Easier said than done.
There was a stiffening to attention of the groups outside the tents. The servants scurried out of sight, and Miriam suddenly whipped a noose over my head and thrust me out of my saddle, crying, "Get down! Be still!" As down the hill came a procession in haste. In front was Theodore, with a chico holding a brolly over his head, and in his wake a motley crowd of guards and attendants. I staggered but kept my feet, and was about to protest when Theodore, striding full tilt and shouting abuse at two skinny wretches hurrying alongside him, astrologers, I learned later, caught sight of me and let out a yell of anger.
"You! You have betrayed me! You lied to me!"
He came at me almost at the run, fists clenched, and by the grace of God he was carrying nothing more lethal than a telescope, which he flourished in my face.
"You swore you had no talk with the Gallas, yet they have marched in their thousands and lie now below Sangalat. How came they there? By Mastiat's order, and who prompted her?"
He flung out a hand in denunciation.
"You! As Christ